This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Today we're going to air a special episode, a sort of membership drive best of. Instead of our usual live call-in format, we're bending the rules a little bit to celebrate some interviews from the past year with notable Vermonters. In this one, former Vermont Governor Madeline Cunin. When I spoke with her last September, Cunin was just 2 days shy of her 85th birthday. And it was on the occasion of her book launch, a memoir titled Coming of Age, My Journey to the 80s. We spoke in front of a live audience in VPR's Stetson Studio One. Our conversation was expansive, touching on Cunin's public persona, her personal life, and her time spent encouraging women to be a recognized part of the political landscape. Perhaps most prominent in the memoir is Cunin's desire to age well. I began our chat by reading a passage that appears early on in Cunin's book. Death's black raven perches on my shoulder from time to time. Even when he flies away, I know he's in the neighborhood. I read that passage and then directed it to Ms. Cunin. What a striking image, I said.
That's what 85 does to you. But I have to tell you, the other day, a friend of mine told me that she was going to visit her father in Florida for his 80th birthday. And I thought, boy, that's old.
Do you still think that way? I've heard that from many people. And certainly I'll be 40 in my next birthday and keep thinking, oh, I'm not 40 yet. No, I'm like 25 or 30. So yeah. Do you feel that way still? What age are you?
I can attach it to myself somehow. It's a number that's out there that I'm aware of, but I don't really believe it on some level. But you have to talk about it. And, you know, what I try to do in this book is talk about the changes in my life that come with it. I still find it hard to use the phrase old age or that I am an old woman. That's still somebody else.
You say you have to talk about it, but in fact you don't, and most women don't. And certainly most women in a prominent position of power don't. So why did you feel like you had to talk about old age?
I think a part of me opened up. You know, as a public figure, you have to be careful about what you say and not to be misinterpreted. And you're sort of shrink-wrapped in this public persona. But I just decided it was time to take the cellophane off and talk about what I'm thinking and feeling. And I just got into that pattern somehow. That's the virtue of stepping out of public life, though in a way you're still in it. Mm-hmm. So that's almost a contradiction, but you're in it in a different way. And I think on some level, as a public figure, sometimes you're caricatured as the politician. And I want to reveal more of who I am. And yet I'm a little nervous about that at the same time.
You told me when you came in this morning that you're starting to have writer's remorse.
Yes. Yes. Not totally, but it's still a major seismic shift to be out there in your private thoughts and reflections. I find I also want to share what I'm experiencing. I have a poem in there that I call a love poem, and a woman at Wake Robin came up to me and said, I'm so glad you wrote that. That's how I feel about my husband. So if I could make those connections, then I'll feel it's worthwhile. It's worthwhile taking the risk.
You reveal yourself as a poet in this book. Essays are interspersed with your own poetry. Is that something you didn't feel comfortable revealing in your previous books?
Well, the poems by nature of poetry, I think, are more reflective than prose. And I've been writing poetry off and on, but not assiduously. I mean, the last 3 years, I focused more on poetry. And it's a happy discovery. Again, when I'm writing it, I don't visualize a big public out there. You sort of go into your inner self. And I'm glad. I have done a couple of poetry readings, so I've been encouraged by the response.
Governor Cunin, there's a very beautiful black and white photo of you on the cover of the book, and I'll show the audience. It's really stunning. And it's a current photo, or relatively current, and you actually write about it in the book, which I've never seen anybody write about the cover photo of their book, and you say, You had to kind of swallow hard to allow a photo with all your wrinkles to be shown on the cover of the book. Does this book make you feel vulnerable?
Well, the words make me feel even more vulnerable than the photo. But no, I'm quite pleased with the photo.
It's a beautiful photo. It's really striking.
It really is. And Todd Lockwood took the photo a couple of years ago, actually. I haven't counted the lines. At first, when I saw it, I thought, uh-oh. And then I sort of got used to it, like when I look in the mirror.
We have a note from Elizabeth in Jericho who says, have you always seen yourself as a public person, one who can lead others?
Not always, no. I developed into that person. You know, I didn't take a course in leadership, or I cared about the issues, and my leadership developed about my passion for change.
We have another note from Sharon in Springfield who says, I'd like to ask Ms. Kunin if she still has a bucket list, and if so, what's on it?
Well, I say in one poem, I'll never see New Zealand or the Cape of Good Hope, but I'd still like to see New Zealand and the Cape of Good Hope. But the bucket list is mainly to stay alive and stay useful and be nice to other people.
Although you do say in the book as well that you don't want to live past your ability to think clearly, to express yourself, and to move around. And, you know, some people do provide for that eventuality. Is that something you're thinking about, not getting to that point, and how to make sure you don't live past that point?
Well, of course, it's impossible, except if you commit suicide or death with dignity, to time your demise. That's one of the mysteries of living. But yes, I think like a lot of people, I wouldn't like to cling to life when I can't make sense anymore.
I think it is a specific feature of a memoir about growing old, where you talk about the other people your age or people that you know and live with who have died in various ways. And you know, I don't want to die like this person. I'd rather die like this person. Oh, I saw this person last week, and I think they look like they're doing it the right way. I mean, that's a sort of specific life stage, isn't it, to be looking at your friends and saying, nope, that's not how I want to go. Yeah, you did it right.
It is, and especially living in a retirement community, you see all variations on dying, and you see people in decline, too. And then you see people who are thoroughly enjoying life and active and engaged. So you see the whole spectrum of going from youth to late middle age to I almost said youth, but retirement communities don't dwell on that sector of life. But yeah, you can't control it. You try to control it. But you shouldn't think about it all the time. And I think it's healthy to try to be in the present, try to be in the now. My husband, who passed away in January, we believed in carpe diem. In fact, the engagement ring he gave me says carpe diem in the inside. We knew we didn't have that many years when we got married, but we vowed to make the most of it, which, by and large, we did.
Didn't he say, I'll give you 10 good years?
Yes.
And he did.
He did.
He's very present in this book, and he's written about in the present tense. And he died in January. I was very sorry to hear that. And I'm wondering why you continued to write about him or include him in the book in that present tense. You do have an afterword that's very much of the moment about current politics, but nothing about the fact that John died, and it felt like he's still very much present in your life.
Well, thank you. He is. You know, I'm sure other people say that about their partners, but he was really an extraordinary man. And we shared so much, and it was a great gift to find love and companionship at my age.
Would you like to read one of your poems?
Now that you ask. All right. This one is called No Longer. No longer will we make love before breakfast. No longer will I dream of seeing New Zealand and the Cape of Good Hope or bears in the wild. No longer will I say yes more than no. No longer will danger sparkle and safety look dull. No longer will I look at my body without comparison between who I was and who I have become, blaming the light for the difference. No longer can I toss my hair over my face and count 100 strokes. No longer can I do without night cream and day cream, slathering on ounce after ounce. No longer can I be comfortable sitting in my chair reading for hours without getting up to stretch my arms and legs. No longer can I walk without looking down at my feet to avoid mean cracks and malicious bumps. No longer can I skip downstairs like a girl, flying without feeling a thing. No longer can I approach the precipice without swaying against my will. No longer do I think ahead of where I will be in 10 years or 20 or more. Now I think in ones or twos or threes, long enough to still hunger for the food of life. No longer do I wish for the next day or the next year to come quickly, like I did the year I turned 10. I want the days to saunter like a leisurely museum stroller who stops now and then to gaze and get closer to the canvas to see the brush strokes and then steps back for the long view before moving on.
We got a note from Rick in Ripton who says, other writers about old age have remarked on the permission they feel to be honest in a new way. Is there anything you now feel you can reveal that you couldn't reveal before?
Yes, and that's what enabled me to write the book, because sort of my own expose. So I'll write it before anybody else does. But there's a certain liberty that you acquire as you get older. I mean, you could say, what the hell? It is freeing. You say there's not that much time left, so you might as well say what you believe and feel. But then, having been political, you know, I was in a discussion with the women's group about clothing that women politicians wear. Should we wear a blouse with frills or a scarf or what? And then I realized at one point, I don't have to care anymore. I can wear what I want. You can just be a bit more open and you won't get punished for it as you would if you were in political life. I remember a caller when I was governor and the fashion was colored stockings and I wore gray stockings. And somebody objected to the color of my stockings. Well, now I can wear red stockings like you're wearing.
Yes, and thanks to other women who have come before me, I can wear red stockings and not worry about my career either.
In case you don't see them.
That's right, bright red stockings today. I wanted to be bold for Madeline Cunin. You know, you write about other things, too, that I think you probably had to be more careful about when you were governor or when you were an ambassador. You talk about things like people, men, not missing an opportunity when you were governor to kiss you on the cheek and say, I've never kissed a governor before. You know, and that kind of small but belittling kind of behavior that you experienced a lot and had to shrug off. And now you can mention that without worrying about what people are going to say about you and how that might affect your career.
Right, right.
Being more free to share your feelings and share those sort of micro injustices that have been done. And I imagine that right now is a particularly poignant moment for you as you look at, again, as it happened 27 years ago, women running for office in greater and greater numbers. And that's something that you have had a big role to play in Vermont and beyond.
For years, I've been giving speeches and writing about and encouraging more women to run for office. And overnight, it almost seems women have decided, because of the difficult times we're living in with this president, it has been a real motivation, a real push forward on the part of women who were reluctant about stepping out of their private zone and into the public eye. I think there's a strong feeling that we must do this. because so much is at stake. And then, of course, watching the Brett Kavanaugh hearings reminds me of the time in 1991 where I testified before the Senate Judiciary Committee. It was an all-male committee. I was asked to testify with a panel from Planned Parenthood. And I remember the seething anger I felt when I looked at this panel of all men and thought, they control our lives. And something just so unjust went through my body, and I felt, we've got to change this. We have changed a lot, but we're still not where we should be.
What did you say when you testified in the Clarence Thomas nomination hearings, and you supported Anita Hill, but what did you say in your testimony?
You know, I don't remember exactly, unfortunately, but I strongly supported Anita Hill's testimony, and we knew at that time that Clarence Thomas was anti-choice and highly conservative, so we did our best to influence the panel. They were pretty set in their ways. I remember a senator holding up a book and implying that she fantasized.
She, Anita Hill?
Yes, Anita Hill. I don't remember who first said it, but they said it in the press afterwards. She's a little nutty and a little smutty. And that just, I mean, women weren't believed at all. They're still not going far enough in this contemporary case, but at least you get the sense from the public that a large sector of the population does believe Dr. Ford and the other women.
Well, on that, Barrett in Huntington, who's here today, says in many ways we're reliving the Clarence Thomas hearings at which you testified. Do you think we've progressed, and do you have hope that we'll ever get it?
I think we've progressed, that there's a real public outcry, and that the politics have changed, that they seem to be sensitive about the women's vote and recognize the power of the vote. And there was pushback the following year in 1992. A lot of women were inspired to run for office when they saw the men calling all the shots. But it's not enough to call in the FBI, for example, which would provide a much better analysis of getting to the truth. So the good news is women are running, women are energized, not just in politics, but in their everyday decisions, like the teacher strike in several states in the spring. So I think we have moved on. We've got a long way to go.
Sebastian is calling in from Montgomery. Hi, Sebastian. You're on the air.
Hi, Governor Cunin. First of all, two things. One, your son is my cardiologist, so thank you. Son, who keeps me ticking occasionally, not often, but luckily for me. So the other question that I have for you is, what do you think that we as Vermonters can do to sort of bridge the gap that seems to be widening daily between Republicans, Democrats, progressives, and all of us who live together here in this beautiful place? How do you think we can come together once this mess is over? Thank you.
That's a very good question. And you've just given me what every mother loves. A notice of her son. But I guess the other thing is talk to each other. And we have more of a chance to do that in Vermont, in that we're small and we meet at the general store or the post office. I don't want to sentimentalize it too much, but we have more opportunities than people have in most states. I think dialogue and civil dialogue. I mean, I confess I sometimes switch the station when certain people are on it. So I don't always practice what I preach. We have to tune in to the other side and then pause and respect what they're saying.
Do you think we don't do that enough, that pause and respect part of it, even when we are, in theory, listening to one another?
I think so. I think we all need to brush up on that technique.
We are listening today to our conversation with former Vermont Governor Madeline Cunin from last September, just as she was launching her memoir, Coming of Age. We pick up the conversation with Cunin answering listener Hillary from Burlington's question, asking, what do women need to focus on right now to positively impact our current political climate?
First of all, vote. I mean, there's still a lot of people who don't, but we know, especially, you know, when elections are won sometimes by two votes. So get engaged. Teach yourself what is going on. Be aware of the political currents and the political differences. Vote and encourage other people to vote. And then speak up. I mean, you can't be passive in these times, and you can't expect someone else to do it for you. I mean, I talked to a person the other day, they said, well, I'm not political. And she lives in Texas. So I made a real pitch. Because it's a very tight race, and she can make the difference. So people who've sort of written off voting, I don't do that, like I don't smoke, I don't drink, I don't vote. We just got to say this, be a citizen, speak up for your rights.
You recount a moment in the book when you had first gotten elected to the House of Representatives, the Vermont House of Representatives, and you were in, I think it might have been, I don't remember whether it was on the floor or in committee, and you felt like, oh my gosh, did I just miss a meeting? They're announcing the appointments to various committees, and I didn't know I was on one. And somebody said, I nominate Madeline Cunin as secretary, and you said, I decline. Would you advise that women don't take a role that has pigeonholed them into sort of a women's role? Because you said, no, I'm not doing that. I'm not going to be the secretary. And then you went on to this brilliant career. Was that a part of it, actually saying no to opportunities rather than, oh, I could do that, and then maybe I could move into this, and if I prove myself as secretary, maybe I'll really show everybody?
Well, that was a tough moment, but the whole atmosphere I felt in the room. This was the Joint Fiscal Committee, which is a powerful committee that meets in between legislative sessions and controls the purse strings. And I'd just been appointed chair of the Appropriations Committee, so I felt I deserved, as much as the guys had, deserved the same kind of attention. So, I'm glad I didn't. Sometimes you do have to decline, but then I ran for lieutenant governor before I ran for governor, and I knew at that time I had to sort of prepare myself, not only to myself to be able to picture myself as a statewide office holder, but to the public. So lieutenant governor isn't a very powerful position, but it's a good study, a good step. And so it depends on the situation, I would say. But often women are sidelined and are sidelined into human services where they're not in the main stream of progress. You look at organizations, not just political, how people do get to the top. Some go step by step up the ladder, and some just jump to the top. So you have to analyze each situation.
You also say that one of the most important things you did was, after losing your first run for governor, to run again and not to take that loss and sort of crawl back with your tail between your legs, but to say, yep, I'd rather try this again and lose than not try it again.
Yeah, that was a hard decision because you give so much of yourself in a race and you're exhausted. But I had a year in between, which I spent in the heady and happy environment of Harvard. We won't go on about that, but it was good. It was a good way to recuperate. And though at sherry and wine parties, I had to learn to stand in one place and not work the room, which I was so used to doing. So I just didn't want to go down as a loser. I mean, that may be a strange way to put it, but you know, there's a loss and a loss. I didn't get clobbered. it was a close race. So I felt
and to remind people who may not have been alive at that time or might not remember, Governor Snelling had said he wasn't going to run again. You got into the race, and then he said, actually, I am going to run again. So you were running against an incumbent, which is always a challenge.
Yeah, it was. It was. And I also want to prove something to my children, that you can't pick yourself up after a defeat.
We're talking again today with former Governor Madeline Cunin in front of an audience at VPR's Stetson Studio One. I want to make sure we have some time for other questions, Governor Cunin, but before we do, can you describe your concept of a quiet restaurant? Because I'm ready to buy shares in this concept, and I just think it's brilliant.
Well, I've written that what I'd really like to do is start a restaurant, but it would be called a quiet restaurant. There would be thick carpets, padding on the ceiling, and heavy curtains, and you could actually be talking about other people and not be heard by the next table. And I realized that it'd be an older age group, not your typical bar scene, and young people wouldn't want to go there, but 10 years or 20 years later, they'd be waiting to get in line, fiddling with their hearing aids.
I'm ready now. When you start the quiet restaurant, that can be the next chapter in your life. I love that idea. We have two questions about your brother, Edgar May. Howard says, can you mention Edgar, your brother, and his contribution to Vermont? And Susan in Montpelier says, you and your brother Edgar had an extraordinary odyssey on your ways to Vermont. Have you any wisdom to share about sister and brother relationships?
Well, it was unusual that we were there together. When we were both in the legislature, they call the roll alphabetically, and K comes before M. His last name is my maiden name, May. And he got so upset one day because people said, hey, you're voting with your sister again? That he asked the clerk to call the roll backwards. And of course, nobody knew how to vote then because it was all in a different order. But no, we were very close. You know, we shared the same ideals. It was interesting that we both went into politics, and he was a journalist, in fact, a prize-winning journalist, and he was my older brother. He also got upset when people asked, who's older? we had a wonderful relationship. There was a tiny bit, which my staff noticed, a sibling rivalry. They blamed it on the fact that when I was 5 years old, he took my tricycle apart and never figured out how to put it back together again.
You talk in the book about how, as you have gotten older, you've wanted to learn more about your family, and your family scattered in World War II, and that's you and your brother moved here with your mother. And your brother was older than you. He died recently. And you asked him to share stories about your father, who died when you were quite young, and you hoped Edgar would have some memories, and you've hoped to find out more about them. That seems like something I hear frequently from people as they get older, this desire to really connect with your family roots in a way that maybe were too busy to do in earlier years. Have you had success with that, figuring out and finding and connecting with your family?
Some success. I was born in Switzerland, and Edgar was born in Switzerland, and my mother. My father was German, and they lived in Switzerland. In our case, we sort of spread around as people tried to avoid Hitler. Some of my family went to Israel, some went to America, some went to London. So I've been trying to reconstruct it as best as I can. I think it's important for my children and grandchildren to kind of trace these strands of family relationships. And, of course, Ancestry.com helps these days. But I think it's a rich experience to know where you come from. Members of my family died in the Holocaust, and I've always sort of connected to the Holocaust experience, and part of my motivation to run for office has been in response to the Holocaust, to express my gratitude for living in the United States of America, where I could run for office and I could speak out without prejudice. And that's a great gift.
You mentioned as well that you pressed Edgar for memories of your father. Your father committed suicide when you were 2.5, and you don't have memories of him the way you thought Edgar might. And Edgar would say, "I don't remember." And you wonder in the book whether he really didn't remember or whether he might be protecting you, even as you were aging, still protecting you from things that he thought might hurt you.
Might be. He was also protecting himself in a way, because he didn't want to talk about it. And suicide leaves a very complicated story behind how people react to it. You never quite get over it, as you don't get over other deaths, but suicide is tough.
We have a note from Carol in South Burlington who says, "I just want to thank you for being a role model for all of us, but especially for women and for our daughters."
Thank you.
And let's go to Maxine, who's calling in from Montpelier. Hi, Maxine. Go right ahead.
Hello, Madeline. This is Maxine Leary, and I worked with you on your campaign in 1984, and I wanted to thank you for trusting me at that time to take charge of your database for your campaign contributions and generating reports for your staff, even though I was a 55-year-old woman at that time. And definitely it was a time for 18 to 22-year-old males to be doing that. I want to thank you for trusting me with it. I went on to make a living in the computer field. I'll be 89 years old in a few weeks, and I'm still learning more and more about the computer. Thank you for all you've given all of us in so many ways.
Thank you. It's your turn to write a book about how it feels to be 89 and a computer whiz.
We have Gail in the audience from St. Albans saying, "Any surprise discoveries that appeared to you as you're in your 80s?
That I'm still curious, you know, that I still want to try things. You know, things I can't do. I can't climb Mount Everest or do daring physical things. I look down at my feet, as I said in that poem. But, yeah, that you can still have fun and enjoy life.
We have a note from Anne who says, "I've often seen you at concerts. What role does music play in your life, and has it changed as you come of age?"
Well, I have more time. My life when I was in public office was tightly scheduled, and now I have more ability to choose where I want to go. And I love music, all types of music, really, except very loud music. And just the community feeling of being at the Flynn Theater or wherever. I like it with the live audience best because you really focus. And we have so much music in Vermont.
Let's go to Joe, who's been waiting on the line from Bridport. Joe, you're on the air.
Hi. I wanted to say to Madeline that among my circle of friends, she was a very highly respected governor, and I miss her terribly since she left office. There's no governor since who's anywhere near measured up in my book. While you were in office, I had a running dialogue with the Department of Transportation about some of their make-work projects. I got a whole lot of lame excuses back. I sent you the whole paper trail, and you wrote me a very nice letter agreeing with me, and I really appreciated that.
Thank goodness.
Joe, thanks for your comment. Lots of people remembering things from previous days in Vermont politics, Madeline Kunin.
Well, that's kind of nice. Warm, cuddly feeling.
It's like this is your life. We should just bring people out now from the background. Rob in Burlington says, "Vermont's generally seen as a beacon of liberal and progressive politics. Many Vermonters like to think about Vermont through this lens. But I think there's a tension I feel due to you being Vermont's one and only woman governor. And Vermont is the only state not to send a woman representative to Washington. Burlington has never elected a woman mayor. Can we truly boast that Vermont is progressive in light of these facts?
Well, that's a good question. And I think we still are progressive despite these facts. But it's still hard for women to break through those barriers, and even harder at the local level than it is at the state level. We're weak both that no woman has ever been elected to Congress and that we have a very paltry number of women in city councils, town councils, and mayors. But I think this will be the year when more people will wake up and respond to the miserable statistics we have in those two areas. Even local politics has been, or maybe especially local politics, has been sort of an old boys' club. And the same people run year after year, and people are kind of comfortable with that. I think we're on the edge of change.
We have a minute left. I'm curious what you think your legacy will be or what you hope it will be.
Well, it's always a tough question because I hate to brag about myself, though of course I'm doing that. But the two pieces of legislation, Dr. Dinosaur and the Housing and Conservation Trust Fund, but I don't know if it'll be my legacy. I'm just pleased with those two things. But probably appointing a record number of women in my administration, and they themselves have become role models and leave behind stunning careers. Other governors have felt compelled to do likewise. That may be one legacy. You know, I'm very honored to have been able to serve the people of Vermont. I'm not the typical politician. I didn't come from a political family. I didn't come from a wealthy family. I'm always a little surprised that I actually did it.